When operations in Fletcherville ended, the Witherbys and George R. Sherman spearheaded the formation of the Cedar Point Iron Company, now the site of the Van Sluten Marina. The blast furnace built along the lake was the company's last effort at remaining viable. It is here where we see the beginning and end of Witherby Sherman and Company. In contrast to operations in Pennsylvania and the Midwest, Witherby Sherman did not have a well-integrated operation that would have helped it run more efficiently. There were no iron manufacturers in the region that could fabricate the iron into finished products. Instead, the company had to send its raw ore or pig iron to factories downstate or even further. In addition, there was no nearby source of coal to fuel the furnaces.
And then there was Andrew Carnegie in Pennsylvania, who had it all at the tip of his fingers, owning the coal and iron mines, the shipping company, and the entire means of processing steel all in one place. Thomas Witherby was the guy in charge of the new furnace at Cedar Point. Using his experiences from Fletcherville, he oversaw construction and served as iron master for more than a decade. His innovative patents and furnace design were known nationally. In 1875, the modern blast furnace went into operation. In 1885, another company added a steelmaking plant at the site, using a technology to process steel that was meant to rival the Bessemer method and revolutionize the iron industry. The efforts to introduce this new steelmaking process in Port Henry suggest that local iron industrialists were attempting to keep up with the latest technology. RPI students eagerly visited the furnaces at Cedar Point to see Thomas Witherby's innovations and the latest steelmaking technology.
We found the workmen very obliging and were shown all through the works our knowledge of blast furnaces being materially increased thereby. The furnace itself is 67 feet in height and was running in full blast, producing about 70 tons of pig per day. Four ovens made after the Whitwell plan are used to heat the blast, the air passing through one all the time and through the others in turn every hour. The heat, of course, is derived from the gases brought down from the top of the furnace, a portion being carried over a building opposite the furnace and burned there to produce extra heat for the machinery.
We could almost imagine ourselves in the infernal regions when the ball which closed the top of the furnace was lowered and the flames and burning gases shot up to a height of 50 feet with a roar like the muttering of thunder.
We next visited the engine room and inspected the immense blowing engine, which gives a sufficient blast for all ordinary purposes. At about 9 o'clock, the cinder or slag was run off, the molten river lighting up the whole place. And a few minutes after 10, the furnace was tapped for the iron.
The scene of the swarthy men moving around almost in the midst of the fiery mass rushing out of the furnace, directing its course into the molds, the dark night outside, and the almost unearthly brightness within, tended to cause one to feel awed and impressed. And we watched the operation in silence, interested beyond measure. At length, the molds were full, and from the tap hole there came forth a sheet of flame instead of the liquid stream before. Soon, the hole was blocked up, the iron in the mold, and sank into a dull red heat. And the operation was over.
We wended our way to the hotel and retired to our rooms to dream of red-hot iron and blast furnaces all night.
But the senior trip experiences for the students at RPI were changing as the industry here declined. When the students arrived in 1886, they were disappointed to discover that the steel plant at Cedar Point was no longer in operation. "The process does not seem to be a success," they wrote in their school paper. They also noted that the bloomery furnaces they visited in Ironville, where wrought iron was made directly from iron ore, was a process that had become rare and was gradually disappearing. I tried to imagine those students at their 10-year reunion at their alma mater.
"What's a reunion without my old friend Andrew? Cheers. Congratulations on the job at Mesabi. When did you start?"
"Spring of 95. Never expected I'd go further west than Rochester."
"Well, the United States is nothing if not expansive. The world's your oyster. Glad you made it back for the reunion."
"I wouldn't miss it. Say, did you hear that they've canceled the senior trip to the mines up north?"
"What happened? Were the boys causing too much trouble?"
"Nothing of the sort. They became indifferent to the whole thing. students complaining that their knowledge wasn't increasing compared to the outlay of funds to make the trip.
I am sorry for those boys. That trip allowed us to understand the 1,001 little points which no textbook, however good, could make clear.
Well, I wouldn't be where I am in the industry if it weren't for seeing firsthand the operations in Mineville and Cedar Point. But now they say the furnace fires have all gone cold, and stacks of pig iron are piling up at the furnace yard awaiting shipment.
Port Henry was changing from the lively place it once was.
After a brief burst of profit gained during World War I, Witherby Sherman and Company decided to take the risk and build another state-of-the-art furnace. The company borrowed $5 million and began construction. The furnace was completed and ready for production in 1923. The owners remained hopeful, even expanding the workforce. When immigration restrictions from Europe increased after World War I, the company began recruiting blacks from the South. Yet, it would be too little, too late. When the Great Depression struck in the 1930s, the company had a difficult time operating at a profit, shutting down the mines for long periods at a time. In 1938, as American industry began gearing up for World War II, Republic Steel leased the Witherby Sherman mines and facilities, modernizing them into profitability. But it wouldn't last. The mines were shut down for good in 1971, right after Labor Day vacation. As deep into the earth as iron was dug, mining went even deeper into the culture of the people. What did they do when it was over? The noises ceased and the rest was silence. Patrick Farrell pegged the reality.
The town is quiet now. There is a new generation of adults who have never heard the whine of winding hoist ropes, the rumble of skips bringing ore to the surface, the thumping sound of the jaw crusher, and ore striking the sides of metal storage bins. Nor have they heard the wailful sound of locomotive whistles signaling at road crossings as ore was brought down to the lake from the mines. Only photographs remain of the 100-foot-high headframes outlined against the sky that identified the town. The underground mine workings have been flooding.
The glow from the furnace fires painted the heavens and showed them the worth of their mining endeavors. As years became decades and then became score, they taught their sons skills as well as mine chores. And their footsteps would follow for a century and more. For this was the legacy of men who mined ore. For this was the legacy of men